In lines right next to the lines that are quoted in this reading from Jesus in the Bible, they're talking about, Jesus is talking about, again, how to pray. And he makes the statement that we don't need to beseech God with a long list of all the needs that we have, because, and this is how he puts it, before you ask, God knows your need. And that particular phrase really resonated, and I've been contemplating it since I read it recently. Just all the implications of that that are so different than the way that we actually live. Most of us live right on the edge of constant awareness of all the things that we hope will happen, or the things that we hope won't happen, or that we wish didn't happen, or whatever it might be. This constant out of attunement with circumstances as they are. In the affirmation that David was reading tonight, this morning, he was also talking about the tendency to have a reaction to everything that happens. The image is given of a car riding over a rutted road. When it's trying to go forward, it not only goes forward, it goes up and down a great deal. And if you think about trying to go forward also going up and down, you can see how much energy is just dissipated in absolutely nothing except going in circles. A friend once asked Swami the question. He was talking about his own, he characterized it as a Gemini nature, who always liked to be starting new things, and he was aware of the fact that his spiritual progress was less stellar than he had hoped, because every time he got started on a path and sort of got into it a little bit, he'd get a little bored, and then he'd go off and look for something else. And then the excitement of starting something new would get him going all again, but then he would realize gradually he would just end up right back where he started. And Swami remarked to him, yes, going in circles does give you a certain sense of accomplishment. The bigger the circle, the bigger the sense of accomplishment. But in the end, you're standing right where you were standing, that certain decisions have to be made at a certain point, and then you have to go forward with them. On Tuesday nights right now, I'm telling the story of the Mahabharata, which is one of the great epics of India, and the power of that story, which is both allegorical and historical, and has been greatly embellished by the sages over time in order to encapsulate in story form many great and important principles. And many people say that the capacity of India to have maintained contact with the high nature of its culture through all of this Kali Yuga period, this period of darkness and confusion that the planet's been through and is only just emerging from, is largely because of those epics. And even Yogananda, an autobiography of a yogi, describes the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. He describes himself as having a bittersweet relationship with them, because whenever his mother wanted to discipline him, she'd pull a story out of one of those epics, and she'd talk about the hero and what he did or didn't do and what the consequences of his behavior were. But it's, of course, a painless way to learn things. And there's one character in that story. His name is Karna. And without spoiling the suspense for those of you who are going week by week through this story, Karna is a very tragic character because he has tremendous positive qualities, but he's fatally cursed for a whole lot of reasons. But one of the things that happens is early on, he commits himself to the wrong side of the battle, even though, as it turns out, his actual heritage, he doesn't know who his parents are. And it turns out he belongs. He's a brother to the right side, but his brothers have rejected him, and the other side has been loyal to him. And he says, at a certain point, he says to Krishna, Krishna offers him the truth of his parentage and invites him to abandon the one who's been on his side, go over to his brothers who he knows now will honor him. But he says, I made a commitment. I committed myself here, and when no one else would support me, I made a promise. And he said, even though now I see that that promise is going to take me to my doom, he said, I am a man of honor and I must keep my word. And I was thinking just about the power of knowing what you stand for and where you're going to go and how you're going to live it. And Master himself talks about Americans, and he has many things positive to say about the American can-do spirit and the willingness to go forward and the creativity. When Swami Kriyananda, in the practice of Kriya Yoga, there's a possibility, because you're doing a certain breathing exercise, that they recommend that you put a little oil in your throat to keep your throat lubricated and comfortable while you're doing the exercise. And so Swami Kriyananda suggested, maybe if we put a little, I think he said, mint oil into the oil, then you'll have this other sensation that will be positive that you're trying to have. And Master, when he heard that, he just laughed and laughed. He said, Americans are always trying to make it better. You know, this tradition is thousands of years old, but we look at it and we just try to figure something out. When we were traveling in India, we used to, David and I and another couple of friends, we used to take trips to India, and we took a lot of Americans with us, introduced them to the Indian culture. And there was this one man, and he was standing on a roadside, and we were watching a lot of people do a lot of very hard work by hand. And these women were walking down the hill, and then they were filling this little bowl on their head with rocks, and then they were walking back up the hill, and then they were putting the rocks. He stood there and watched it for a minute. He said, I'm hopelessly American. I would invent a machine. You know, there's just no way that I could just go on like this. This is who I am. This is who I have to be. And that's a very positive aspect of America. But the other side of it is that we're a very, very restless country. And we, because we are capable always of transforming things, we tend to think that change is the way to go. This is exactly what David was reading this morning. People mistake movement for progress. Because we're making a lot of movement, we think we're actually going forward. And so we are very fickle in our commitments. And Master said that's a great weakness of our country. He said we change jobs, we change cities, we change marriage partners. You're just at the drop of a hat. We're just always going somewhere else, the best and the worst. I joke about myself is that I don't have a lot of endurance, or I should say I used to not have a lot of endurance. I've improved over the years. But the positive quality of that is I'm very creative, because if I can't stand it, I just can't stand it. I have to invent a machine. There has to be an alternative to this. And our weaknesses play into our strengths, and so we move forward. Now, when Jesus tells us that we don't even have to ask God because God already knows, he's talking not just about, oh, well, you know, he'll take care of you. He's talking about a relationship, our relationship to the infinite, that we need to contemplate more deeply, and we need to understand the implications of this. How does God know what we need? I mean, how is God able to hear our thoughts and our feelings and read our karma and understand our destiny long before it arrives and even is an idea in our own mind? How much do we trust that what the divine is sending us is really for our best interests? Or how much do we just chafe against it and go out and try to invent a machine, you know, that'll make it different than it is? And how loyal are we even to our own aspirations? How powerfully are we willing to commit ourselves to that which we know to be true? Last night in this temple, and many of you were here, but not all of you, we had a marvelous presentation from a friend, John Parsons, who's an attorney, who shepherded Ananda through a 12-year cycle of litigation that happened before some of you even got here, because it ended now a decade ago, 1990 to 2002. He's written a marvelous book, which is called Fight for Religious Freedom. And just as a good read, just as a good afternoon read, I highly recommend it. But also as an extraordinary story of divine commitment and of the fascinating way in which God knows your need and sends it to you in the last way that you would ever want to see it. You know? We have to look at this experience of life very differently than we're inclined to. When I first came to Ananda Village, I was 24 years old. I, as many of you know, I was raised in a Jewish family, but I was basically raised without any particular religion. A little bit of cultural Judaism, but basically nothing much more. And I came there and I started hearing Yogananda talking about the teachings of Jesus, which is not what I'd signed up for. I'd signed up for yoga and I'd signed up for, you know, these exotic gurus, and I was way into another culture, and then here he's bringing Jesus back, and it was, well, it was interesting. It was extremely interesting, but wide open to me. And in fact, what I read was the bootlegged copy of the SRF publications that we later got sued for. You know, decades later, I'm in court defending our right to have copied these copyrighted materials so that I could sit as a 25-year-old woman out in the woods and read these things, which weren't available otherwise. But in it, I learned the self-realization nature of Jesus' teachings, that whereas we've all been raised to think West is West, East is East, Jesus is the one or Jesus is not the one, whatever. As a Jew, Jesus was definitely not the one. You know, when I was 10 years old, I used to sit as a little girl, as children do. You know, you put the seat of the toilet lid down and you'd sit there, and my father would shave and I would chat with him and I'd watch him shave. This was the ritual of childhood for me. And I vividly remember one of those times with his face all lathered up in his little brush like he used to use. Daddy, why wasn't Jesus the Messiah? You know, my poor father practically swallowed his shaving brush. You know, what is he supposed to say? He didn't have a deeply religious nature, but, you know, clinging to your Judaism was really important. And one of the greatest definitions of Judaism, forgive me, is that we don't accept Christ. It's a really important part of it. So I wanted to know why. I watched my poor father hem and haw and try to find a reason somewhere, because he didn't know, really. He'd never really asked the question. And I sort of saw that he was just stuck, so I changed the subject. You know, I didn't want to embarrass him any further. This is who we are. We have this point of view. But, you know, it's when I was sitting there reading these bootlegged materials, I realized... And the reading about Jesus and what his message really was, as opposed to what my Jewish culture had told me or my fundamentalist Christian friends would try to tell me, it was of another order of magnitude. It wasn't merely different. It was from another planet. It was completely incomprehensible I was completely out of the context. Here we're talking about the return of avatars repeatedly over time, the self-realization of the individual soul, through many incarnations, we gradually reclaim our divine heritage. We begin to understand why we were born and why we were really born, that Jesus himself, you know, had realized a state of consciousness that all of us would realize, and he had attained it by the same path that I was walking. You know, these moments come, and these moments come to every single one of us. We're all by ourselves often somewhere. Or maybe we're sitting in a crowd, but our consciousness becomes solitary. And I vividly recall sitting there and just feeling like the entire universe suddenly belonged to me in a way that, you know, I was just a little person just struggling along, living in this tiny trailer, having a great time, but nobody, just nobody, one little, you know, how big are we if you really think of the whole thing, which... most people don't want to, because we're really small when you start thinking like that. But at the same time, my potential, more than my potential, my reality was infinite. My reality was the same as Jesus Christ. Wow. You know, even if my people didn't accept him as the Messiah, he was pretty impressive no matter how you measured him. And here Yogananda was telling me, nothing separated us except his realization and my lack of realization. Realization is a very big word, because realization means it's already there. You just don't know it. And thus, from wherever we stand, Master puts this phrase out, which is so powerful. Spirit is center everywhere. Center everywhere. You can start at any point, and we have to start within our own selves, because what else do we have? We walk through this world, and we're always walking within our own reality and perceiving from our own point of reference. So how else do we feel, how else do we imagine that our spirituality will ever come to us, except right where we're standing? And then every so often it cracks a little bit in the words of an avatar, the words of a master, or just the sunlight on the water. I was walking, and I don't even remember now, I can't clearly remember where I was recently, and I just walked by some little pond, and it had a green lotuses on it, or green growth of some kind, and the water was very blue. And I was walking like this, and I glanced into it, and then I kept walking. But something, that blue and that green, you know, there was just this ray coming through, just exactly as Gregory was reading. You know, I look at some beautiful aspect of nature, and then all of a sudden, it ceases to be what it is, what it appears to be, and it suddenly becomes what it is, which is center everywhere. Sri Ramakrishna, a great avatar of the 1800s in India, they describe the legend of his life is that his first cosmic consciousness experience, he was born, realized, but the first thing that manifested in this incarnation, he was just walking. And there was a white cloud, and then a flock of geese flew across it. And the stark contrast between the black and the white suddenly opened up for him the entire nature of the dual nature of this universe. And he went into a superconscious state. And just as they found this little boy, he was 6 or 7, and they found him inert on the ground, and it took some time for him to come back. He just left this world entirely. Just the geese against the sky had opened up for him this reality. Now, what makes that possible is exactly what Jesus is telling us. We're always living in the presence of the one who loves us. And all of the saints and masters offer us this extraordinarily challenging idea. If you knew how much God loves you, as the French saint said, you would die for joy. And recently there's been a book published by an Indian woman from Hong Kong who was dying of cancer, really dying of cancer, and was in the hospital for weeks and then went off into the astral worlds. And because of what she experienced when she came back, the cancer went away. And she's written a book, Dying to Be Me, I think is what it's called. But the main lesson she learned from that experience was once she stepped away from this tight hold we have on making sure that we're so proud of our littleness and have no idea the extent to which it torments us. And she stepped away from that and just realized how much we are loved. Just how much we are loved. We work so hard to be loved. And we're fighting all the time to assert our needs and make sure people know and my voice is heard and I've established my boundaries and all these different things. Thinking that by tightening up our grip on our separateness, somehow we'll get what we want. And what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. That's how Krishna puts it. And what's night to the yogi is day to the worldly man. And what I'm saying here is this is a revolution. This is a revolution of every aspect of everything that we think. This is not just business as usual. This is not just a pretty room where we come together. This is not just let's all be a little bit nicer. I had a friend who attends here sometimes, but has a deep commitment to home, family, husband, grandchildren, parents, you know, the whole thing. Swamiji sometimes writes in some of his books, you know, you dedicate yourself to these children, and then they grow up, and then they have children, and you dedicate yourself to your children's children, and then if you live long enough, they have children, then you have grandchildren, then you die, and you get to be born as their children, and it just goes on and on and on and on, you know, and he's never had any sentimental attitude toward these things. I mean, it manifests sometimes amusingly when he meets animals, which he described once to me. He said, Whenever I see all living creatures, he said, including animals, they're just, it's just consciousness on a spectrum between God realization and a lack of understanding of our true nature. He said, even animals, they're just on the spectrum, just like human beings. Human beings are more aware, but it's not a different reality. So often when a dog or something comes into his purview, he says like this, "Hello, beast," just like that. "Hello, beast, how nice to see you." You know, nothing, it's just, it just sees it for what it is. It's a beast, it's an animal, it's a creature trying to get toward God realization. He tells the story of when he was at 29 Palms, the desert retreat with Yogananda, and there was a neighboring dog named Bo that used to come over. And the dog would come over, especially at lunchtime, because he would smell food. And Master pointed out how his brow, the dog's brow, would wrinkle in concentration, you know, trying to find the food. Not different than us, just a little more limited in what it's trying to find. But my friend, with her emotional and, you know, karmic commitment to this reality, she became very insecure one day and said to me, "I don't really feel that you all stand by family values. You don't value family enough." And that for her was a pretty strong criticism. I said, well, if you think about having lived thousands and thousands of incarnations, it's really harder to get really excited about where you are right now. When Devi Novak sometimes tells the story of she and Jyotish, they're the spiritual directors of Ananda, they have one son. And when that child was born, Devi's labor progressed more quickly than anybody actually realized in the moment. So she was, I've never given birth to a child, but I understand they call the transition, you know, just before the baby's, you can push the baby out. It's a very emotionally sensitive time. And she had been very courageous, but she was getting a little anxious. And her nervousness expressed herself, and Jyotish wanted to comfort her. And he tried to comfort her in his immensely philosophical way. "Devi," he said, "just think how many babies you've given birth to over the course of many incarnations." You know? He said, "certainly enough to populate the entire city of Sacramento," he said to her. And she says later, just right in the middle, you know, of the birth of her first and only child, if he'd said Paris or Rishikesh or something like that, you know, would have said, he said Sacramento. She said she had a picture of Denny's, 24-hour Denny's, and all these people going in and out of Denny's, you know, and all of them were babies she'd given birth to in one lifetime or another, you know, but it broke the tension. He knew his wife well, she loved her husband, and then everything went smoothly and the baby was born. But we are part of a very, very different reality. You know, we think everything that happens to us in this unique incarnation has so much significance. And the paradox of it is, which is so, it's so dear. I think Master describes it somewhere, and I'm not going to quote it accurately, but he talks about the paradox of omnipresence, of infinity, which therefore means it's also infinitesimal. If God is equally present everywhere, he is equally present everywhere. And in the tiniest little thought and feeling you have, you know, the divine is just as manifest. And we divide ourselves away from God by saying, this is important, this isn't, this I'm proud of, this I'm not proud of, this I'll show him, this I'll hide from him. Dr. Ritchie, who talked about a death and return experience, and he was, I won't go through the whole story, but he was in a 360 degree panorama. He died of the influenza during the Second World War as a soldier. He was 21. And then he came back, and his whole life was, of course, changed. And because he was a devoted Baptist, I believe, he saw Jesus, who met him, because that was who he loved. And so he and Jesus are standing in this 360-degree panorama of his entire life, and he's watching the whole thing. And he had not been nice. And he tried to claim that he was young, and he didn't know any better. And he watched himself be conceived. He watched himself grow in the womb. He watched himself emerge from the womb. I mean, these are fascinating things to think about. And then he watched himself grow up to be a pretty cold-hearted, selfish little boy. And his mother had died, and his stepmother was a dear and wonderful woman and did everything she could to love him and take care of him, and he would have none of it. And standing there in front of Jesus, he was just mortified. And he kept trying to say, "I'm so young, I'm so young." And Jesus kept saying, "How much have you loved? How much have you loved? How much have we loved?" You know, we excuse ourselves in all kinds of ways. I'm not capable, I have to think about myself. But really, there's only one reality. How much are we a manifestation of who we really are? And who are we really? We are the power and the presence of God. We are infinite in our potential. We are infinitely loved. And we justify so much narrowness. And we imagine that it makes us happy. And the masters just, they do their best. You know, God knows they do their best. Jesus came and he brought to the Jewish people, as it were. He was the avatar to the Jewish people because they were the remnant of the true faith that was still the true faith, meaning the understanding of the true nature of the world, not the true singular faith. They had chosen the divine, truly chosen the divine, and Jesus came to help them understand, look, you all are confused with all these rules and this corrupt priesthood. You need to really get out from under them. He really was very serious. And what happened? His own people crucified him. And they crucified him because he threatened their littleness. And he wept. Jesus wept. Jesus didn't weep because his own body was going away. Jesus knew he'd had countless bodies, and he also knew he could just remanifest this one if he wanted to, which he did very nicely right afterwards. But he wept for us because here he is bringing to us our own liberation. Here he is bringing to us, you know, be ye therefore perfect like our Father in heaven is perfect. I and my Father are one, and that which I am, that which I do, is also your reality. And we said, no, no way. I asked my Father why he couldn't even remember. But we still hold it because we're so confused. And then every so often it breaks through. It just breaks through. The geese fly across the white cloud. The little pond sits over here. A young girl is by herself in the woods reading contraband material that copyright belongs to someone else, you know. And right through it, something about God comes through. I had the most remarkable experience. It may have been the same seclusion, I don't remember. I read this other book by Swami Ramdas. Papa Ramdas is what he was called. He was a Swami from India, not the American Ramdas. This was an Indian one. And this Ramdas just one day decided that God is everywhere, and he walked out of his house saying, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And he walked all over India saying, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Victory to God, God is glory, victory to God. And he walked over mountains and over cliffs and through rivers, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And he was never hindered by anything. And I got so excited. There was a huge pine tree nearby. And I went out, and I went to the top of that pine tree. Just zip, zip, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, right? And then I was at the top. And all of a sudden, I was at the top. And I have vertigo. And I forgot Sri Ram, Jai Jai, Jai Jai Ram. And all I remembered was me. It took me a long time to get down off that tree. I mean, a really long time. I had just, you know, I became terrified. How I ever got up there, I never know. I do remember how I got down. You know, just inch by inch by inch. Oh, Lord, what a picture of one's whole life, isn't it? Every so often we know, we just go out like that, and then some part of it says, are you crazy? Right. No, no, I'm sane. Now I'm sane. Now I'm living for God. Now I'm serving others. Now I'm a humble devotee, I don't care what I do. Now I'm tithing from my tiny salary. You know, now I'm just loving. I'm just loving everyone, whoever I meet, wherever I meet. I'm not weighing and measuring and evaluating and wondering and setting my boundaries. Which, yes, I understand. There's a time when you have to do that. I'm not meaning to be stupid here. But God knows our need before we know it ourselves, because He knows where we came from. He knows where we're going. And the more we put our heart, mind, and soul into that reality, everything else that we seek will also be ours. God bless you.